For the record, could each of you state your full name, starting with Mr. De Pelsmaker?
Tom Willie De Pelsmaker.
Sally Ann Dicey.
And Murray John Brass.
And each of you have given previous planning evidence in relation to this Environment Court hearing on Plan Change 7?
Yes, I have.
Yes, I have.
And I have.
Now, the three of you have participated together with some other planners and other experts in some expert witness conferencing on the topic of deemed permits and associated rights of priorities.
That is correct.
And the three of you have been selected by each of the participants in that conferencing to report back the outcome of that conferencing.
That's correct. Yeah.
The outcome of that conferencing has been recorded in a joint witness statement of 3 and 17 May 2021.
Correct.
And each of you are signatories to that document, together with Mr. Ensor, Mr. St. Clair and Mr. Leslie.
Correct.
Now, I understand that a presentation has been prepared providing a summary of the content of the joint witness statement, and that you will now present that presentation to the court, and then you will answer questions from myself and the other counsel and the court.
That is correct.
If you could proceed with the presentation, please.
Yep. Good afternoon, Your Honour. Good afternoon, Commissioners. Ms. Dicey, Mr. Brass, and myself have together, in consultation with Mr. Ensor, attempted to provide you with a brief overview of the key messages that came out of the expert conferencing on priority rights. We've also attempted to do that in a language that is plain English, easy to understand, so people, lay witnesses or people that want to follow the case online or via the audio can understand it as well. To that effect, we've also included a slide right at the end of the presentation with clarification of key terms. I'm not going to take you through them because I think everybody in this room will probably be familiar with those terms. They are entry conditions, matters of control, Schedule 2 minimum flows, so an explanation of what those terms mean. So I'll take you to the first slide, which again, for the benefit of laypersons or lay experts, explains what a right of priority is. So very briefly, it's a deemed condition that preserves the rights of access to water between permit holders. Now, when preparing for the expert conferencing, we quickly came to the conclusion that most likely most deemed permits have actually a reference to priority rights stated on them. And first we proceeded with a search of the database, and we found that about just over half of the 310 remaining deemed permits in Otago still have priority rights stated on them. Now, it is a database, and the accuracy of the database is dependent on the accuracy with which records have been entered into it. So, therefore, we try to test the accuracy with a manual review of all the deemed permits in 6 catchments, and those catchments were chosen because we knew they had priorities in them. And we found that of all the deemed permits in those 6 catchments, which amounts to 124 deemed permits, nearly 70% of them make reference to a priority right. What we also found is that in some cases they are stated as a condition, in other cases they are stated in an advice note, and in, again, other cases they are stated elsewhere in the body of the text, and that is particularly the case with rights that were issued under the Mining Act, but that have not been granted a right of substitution under the Water and Soil Conservation Act. So those original mining privileges, some of them still exist and are still current. I will take you to the next slide. During the expert conferencing, we went through a number of questions that were presented to us by the Environment Court. And one of them was to look at which types of conditions were put on resource consents that replaced deemed permits. And we were given a list of five types of consent conditions. The first one was right of priorities. So we looked whether there were any existing permits that state a right of priority on them. And we could only find one. And we looked into it. The actual consent is attached to the JWS as well. And it seems to be an anomaly in a sense that it's the only example that we found. It also is a consent that has an expiry date that coincides with the 1st of October expiry date for remaining deemed permits. Then we looked at how many consents have a condition relating to the allocation limit stated on them. Now, we interpreted the term allocation limit in two ways. Firstly, reference to an allocation limit stated in Schedule 2A, or a limit, an allocation limit, determined as 50% of mean annual low flow, which is the default limit set through the plan. None of the resource consents have actually a limit in that sense attached to it. What we do find is that all resource consents do have allocation limits in the sense that they state the instantaneous rate of take and the consented daily, monthly, and annual volumes of water that can be taken under that consent. We also found that both consents within and outside Schedule 2A catchments have been granted with conditions relating to minimum flows as well as residual flows. And then finally, we also found that there are quite a number of consents that have been granted with what we call a take cessation condition. Now, that term is not defined by the plan. It is not defined in Plan Change 7 as well. And during the expert conferencing, we came to a joint agreement that there may be benefit in clarifying that term through Plan Change 7 or in the plan change. Take cessation conditions are conditions that could relate to the following. For example, when a permit holder has multiple permits, the exercise of one permit can be restricted when the other permit is being exercised. In other cases, it might be that water is taken from two different locations under the same permit. Take cessation condition could mean that water taking at one condition needs to cease when water is taken at the alternative location. Or what we found also is upstream of the hydro dams in the Clutha Mata Au catchments, sometimes there are quite complex conditions put on water takes that require takes to cease when the inflows at different points within the catchment are below a certain point. So those are some examples of take cessation conditions. Then we also put our mind to other types of conditions that could be put on resource consents that replace deemed permits. Some of these conditions have actually been applied by the ORC to consents. Others haven't been applied. Those could be conditions that relate to a stepped or a proportional reduction of taking. That is a condition that is generally not applied, or to my knowledge, never has been applied with regard to the taking of surface water. It has been applied for the taking of groundwater, where there are take restrictions at different aquifer levels. Another type of condition could be a residual flow condition to protect access to water for downstream users. At the moment, the policy that provides guidance for the setting of residual flows links the setting of those flows to in-stream values. So it is something that the water plan does not provide guidance on at the moment. Conditions could also relate to augmentation of flows at certain times or at certain levels via dam discharges. And then finally, other conditions could be conditions requiring water taking to be occurring in accordance with an agreement between water permit holders or as part of a group management approach to water taking as well. We also looked at how water users are managing water taking when flows in the source water body are declining. And again, we looked at two possible scenarios. One, where the water users are actually permit holders, and secondly, where the water users are actually shareholders within a scheme, and the scheme itself holds the resource consent. In the first instance, when it's about managing flows between water permit holders, priorities are one important instrument. The other one are flow sharing agreements. And through the hearing, we've heard quite a number of instances we heard about, or witnesses made reference to the false dam agreement. We also heard that in certain locations there is some voluntary trialing with flow sharing agreements as well. But I think we came to the conclusion that those are likely to be exceptions and that the majority of the deemed permit holders would not be part of at least a formalized flow sharing agreement. In terms of how flows or available flows are managed between the shareholders within a scheme, that is usually done in accordance with contractual arrangements, water supply agreements that are drafted or that are agreed between the members of the scheme. We also looked at water management groups and how these are provided for under the water plan and the existing policies of the water plan. Under the water plan, that is generally considered to be a non-regulatory method. It is voluntary for water users to organize themselves in a group, although there are a number of types of water management groups, for example, water allocation committees that can be approved by council and where the rationing regime agreed upon by the members within that allocation committee is also approved by council. While they are non-regulatory, they actually rely on a regulatory driver, a minimum flow, and they provide benefits for water users because they coordinate access to water between them. There's also a benefit for council in terms of the communication with water users and the monitoring of water taking. And then finally, there are some benefits as well to the environment. Water management groups, they help assisting with maintaining minimum flows, but they actually often are used to implement a much wider coordinated management approach. Now on to some of the key conclusions and recommendations. There is a risk. We came to the conclusion that there is a risk both for the environment and for water users if priority rights are not provided for going forward. And when I say forward, in the interim, up until a new land and water plan is made operative. We looked at non-regulatory responses. They would require an amendment to the PC7 planning framework, and that could be done by either drafting such policies or provisions within PC7 or making reference to existing provisions within PC7, but create a link to existing water plan provisions. However, they also require a regulatory driver, like a minimum flow, and that is dependent on complex assessments, and PC7 does not establish those drivers. So while they might be suitable, very suitable going forward in the land and water plan, they're probably contrary to the purpose of PC7 in terms of providing for a simple, cost-effective, and a certain way, especially in light of the need for those minimum flow drivers. As witnesses, we agreed that the following amendments to PC7 would be appropriate. An amendment to the policy framework, which could be either a separate policy or an amendment to one of the existing policies, I'm thinking policy 10A21, and an amendment to rule, the controlled activity rule 10A311, specifically adding a new entry condition and a new matter of control, allowing the water sharing agreements that have been created by priorities, allowing them to be brought forward into the new consents. And as I said before, there would be some benefit in clarifying some terms as well, such as take cessation condition and also the term right of priority.
So I just had one question of clarification, and I was looking at your slide, JWS priorities, types of conditions set on resource consents that replace deemed permits, and looking at paragraph 13 of your joint, of the JWS. And I just wanted to make sure that I've understood this correctly. Here, paragraph 13 is talking about deemed permits. And at subparagraph C, you say, on review, 29 of these permits have minimum flow conditions. So do I understand that to be 29 deemed permits have minimum flow?
No.
Okay.
These are replacement consents.
Sorry?
Replacement consents.
Replacement consents.
Resource
consents
that have been granted for water takes authorized by deemed permits.
Sorry, can you say again what are we referring to here?
So those minimum flow conditions are conditions on resource consents granted or for takes that were previously authorized by deemed permits.
Okay.
So not deemed permits themselves.
Yeah, okay. And then the second question that arises is in relation to those permits which remain deemed permits. I know that we have conditions as to take, and you may have conditions as to the daily, monthly, or annual volume. Can you confirm that?
Usually they are expressed as hourly volumes.
An hourly volume.
Yeah, they wouldn't typically have the full range of limits that you will see on current consents, which is an instantaneous rate of take, and a daily, monthly, or annual. In my opinion, it's often hourly rates of take.
Okay.
Some are the older deemed permits seem to be expressed. Well, it's funny to say older. I think it's if they're being reissued or not. But some seem to be litres per hour, and that is just in the kind of preamble statement rather than as a condition.
Mm-hmm.
And others seem to have conditions which have litres per second, and then sometimes as well an annual volume.
Or sometimes a volume. And is that a daily volume or something else?
An annual volume.
An annual volume.
In addition to the litres per second.
Okay, so sometimes you get litres per hour or litres per second, and then sometimes you get an annual volume on the range of deemed permits that you see. Is that fair? Okay.
Yep. And just as background, a lot of them, when they were originally granted, were granted on the basis of heads, which is one cubic foot of water per second, which equates to 27.7 repeater litres per second, and that's then being translated into litres per second or equivalents on subsequent replacements.
Okay. Would we see any permits with heads annotated, you know, conditions still for heads or not?
So mining privileges which haven't yet been replaced into a new document could still have heads on them, I would think, yeah.
Okay. And so my final question is that I think to confirm my understanding that at least on deemed permits, we are not seeing. So these are the ones which have not been replaced. We're not seeing minimum flows, residual flows or secession type conditions. They're absent from those permits. Correct?
Okay. Correct.
All right.
Yes.
Thank you. Sorry. And now I'm going to, have we got any brief clarifying questions before I hand over? No? All right. I'm going to hand over.
Thank you, Your Honour.
I'd like to start with the slide that's on the screen at present, where the experts have jointly recognised a need for a regulatory backstop, and you've set out the reasons in summary on the slide. Reflecting back on the conferencing that took place, were there any other additional reasons why any of you thought that a regulatory backstop was required in addition to the reasons that have been set out, or is that a full list capturing that which was discussed? And just perhaps, as you're speaking, perhaps say your name first and then give the answer so the transcript can capture who's speaking.
Tom de Pulsmacher. My recollection is that this captures at least the primary reasons. I cannot think of any additional reasons off the top of my head. The key one being is actually it's kind of goes against the intent of the plan change, which is to provide a certain process.
Sally Dicey. I think it was just circling back to earlier evidence that without a regulatory backstop, then there's an enforceability issue about any condition. So it really just came back to that even if non-regulatory methods were used, they still have a regulatory backstop. So that includes the use of flow sharing groups. So while they can be seen as a non-regulatory approach to something, they still do have a regulatory backstop.
And Murray Brass, and related to that, that those non-regulatory methods, flow sharing agreements and water management groups, there's a range of them at different levels of finality, and there's a lot of areas they're not covered by those, so they're not available to sort of pick up and sort of fully bring into the plan, and that they would give the full coverage that would be required. And that then really leads to the conclusion that to create that would require the amendment and the complex assessments.
Tom de Pulsmacher, if I may add to that, also there's a timing issue as well. We've heard a lot of evidence that it takes several seasons sometimes to kind of set up those arrangements and trial them as well. That time is probably not available within the current time frame.
So when you're thinking about the need to reflect the status quo for the next 6 years, do each of you agree that the existence of priorities, whether they are exercised or not, is an important driver in terms of reflecting the status quo?
Tom de Pulsmacher, in certain areas it will. It's unlikely to be the case everywhere, but in certain areas, which based on the evidence, again, that we've heard, have high values, they do play a role. Yep.
Sally Dicey, yes, I think we reached agreement about that priorities can be an important aspect to access to water and have other effects on the environment that comes out of that. And while they may not be used in all cases, the presence of them there uniformly is more likely to keep the status quo intact, such that there is a status quo.
Murray Brass, and I just confirm that I also agree that they are important, and as part of that would note that even where they're not regularly exercised, the low flow conditions, which might only be every 10 years or whatever, that's also the critical time, both ecologically and between water users. So the rare times that they do come into play are those critical times. So yes, they are important.
When you think about the, and I'll describe them as the non-regulatory flow sharing mechanisms that do exist, have I understood the evidence correctly in that the existence of the priorities is one of the key drivers for having successful non-regulatory flow sharing agreements amongst different users?
I think it's Sally Dicey. I think it is one of the drivers that has helped drive a shift towards flow sharing. I think historically priorities have set the scene, and even if they haven't actually been called, so even if a higher priority permit holder hasn't called their priority, the fact that those priorities have existed have still influenced historic water management. I think the other key driver, though, for flow sharing has been the knowledge that they are going to expire and that deemed permits are going to expire and that there has to be a transition away from them. And so a lot of these flow sharing agreements have been developed in anticipation of that expiry and had been undertaken within the context of the existing regional planned water, because that framework had supported the creation of the flow sharing groups, and council had talked to deemed permit holders about moving towards a more collective approach and had encouraged and supported that. So I think priorities have underpinned that and are a driver, but it's also been the expiry, the looming expiry of the deemed permits and the ability to undertake a full and substantive application and assessment process, which is now no longer there.
So accepting then the need, as you've described it, for there to be a regulatory backstop in Plan Change 7 to reflect the, and I'll describe it as the status quo with respect to priorities, and reflecting on the submissions given by Dr. Somerville this morning, where he notes that if a rule involving a priority regime were to be considered in PC7 provisions, it would have to be re-evaluated under the RMA and meet the requirements of sections 66 and 67. So thinking about the need to recognise to bring forward into Plan Change 7 a regime that perhaps reflects priorities, are you of the view that that could be crafted in a way that would fit within the bounds of Section 66 and 67? And I guess that's more at a conceptual level to start with, not at any level of real detail.
Tomlin Pulsmacher, I believe so. I've read the legal opinion. It also makes reference in a footnote, it makes reference to the NPSFM 2020, and I think that's an important factor to take into consideration. If we draft a provision in Plan Change 7 that has the effect of continuing flow sharing arrangements between water users that has been created by priorities, that does not mean that we need to give full effect to the NPSFM, but by doing that, we probably assist in allowing a land and water plan to give full effect to the NPSFM, because I think indirectly it assists with providing for some of the policies in the NPSFM to be looked after. There's a policy that steers us towards not losing any environmental values. So I think it is possible to do that within that context, yes.
Sally Dicey, yes, I think it is possible to do it within that context. I think in terms of regulatory functions, a regional council has to manage effects on the environment, and given the broad definition of environment in the Resource Management Act, including communities and ecological aspects, then that's exactly what carrying priorities over in whatever form that was done, or recreating them under the RMA would be consistent with that.
And Murray Brass. And I think the point for me is that in creating new permits with conditions, is that those conditions would have to stand on their own two feet and not be dependent on what was in the previous. But what previous rights of priority are a matter of fact and record, so they're easily established. But the new condition would have to express that in a way that is complete within that consent, and I think that can be done.
Sorry, can you just clarify what... Are you saying that you are simply going to mimic, if you like, the old priority in the new plan, or are you setting up a regulatory framework which reflects the reality of flow sharing arrangements, which previously were predicated on the priorities but now have moved on for many catchments?
I don't think we have the information to fully recreate the actual flows, but I think we do have the information to mimic the existing priorities.
I thought that was the point of the opinion, is that you're not going to get very far with that, or that there's problems legally with that.
There may be different legal opinions.
I haven't heard them yet.
To that.
Yeah.
And in all fairness, for the council, I do take a different view with respect to Dr. Somerville in relation to the ability to bring down and reflect in RMA terms the priority. So in a sense, there's a live legal question in relation to whether you can do it or not. Mm-hmm. The purpose of my exploring this topic at the minute is to see whether it fits within the RMA umbrella in terms of constructing a set of planning provisions that fit squarely within the RMA and don't rely on a previous regime. So my understanding is that what Mr. Brass is saying is that it would need to be a standalone regime that stands on the conditions of replacement consents that might be issued if the essence of the priorities were brought down into the replacement permits.
Yes, that is correct.
Could follow up for clarification. You have a number of entry conditions already in PC7 that pick up what's in the deemed permit and carry it through. I can't remember all of them, and I don't have the document in front of me, which isn't very clever, but if you had a residual flow or a minimum flow, or even you take in cessation conditions, those are being picked up and put into this plan change. So would priorities be in a similar vein?
Yes, the intention would be to work exactly the same way, and in the same way as once any previous consent has expired, the conditions of it have no ongoing life, they're replaced by the new conditions on the new consent.
Okay.
Priorities would need to be structured the same way.
Yep. No.
Thank you.
I don't
think so. So then, stepping forward, then you are collectively of the view that you could frame up provisions that are responding to what I'll describe as an RMA issue in terms of the need for the regulatory backstop. I want to explore with you now in a little more detail how you might go about that, and I appreciate that you may not have had sufficient opportunity yet to work on matters of detail in terms of drafting, but we'll drill down as best we can. So thinking about what the regulatory response might look like, I'd like to start to understand whether you see any merit or any difficulties with the suggestion that the court floated on Thursday in terms of trying to best encapsulate the status quo through what I'd understood was a series of minimum flows at particular points reflective of the current take of water. So interested in some initial thoughts around whether that's an option worth exploring further, or whether do you foresee any difficulties with that?
I've thought about it, and I had two initial thoughts. My recollection is that the proposal would only apply to the Taari catchment and the Manuhirakia catchment. And my question is there then still not a need for an alternative approach to manage water taking in other catchments in the region where priorities exist and where they have or may have been or may be exercised?
So I can answer that because I thought I gave a clear answer in court. We could only see this. We could only, in terms of the evidence brought to us, which is factual evidence, we could only see our way through to Manuhirakia, and that's perhaps more simple, Taari, a bit more complex, and they're both using different flow regimes to effect alternate flow sharing arrangements for deemed permit holders. We have not got the factual evidence, which isn't to say it doesn't exist or we can't get it, but we haven't got it. For those other key catchments, which you've noted in your JWS.
I appreciate that, Your Honour. Where I come from is there might be a risk that is worthwhile addressing in other catchments. While we haven't received any conclusive evidence on that, it is still something that is probably worthwhile addressing through some kind of regulatory response as well. So you'll end up potentially with a dual regime, one that is for Manuhirakia and Taari, and another regime that is applies to other deemed permit catchments. My second thought was the minimum flows that are currently in the schedule. I am not a hydrologist nor an ecologist, but from experience and from talking to hydrologists and ecologists, they influence ecological, they influence the hydrology in the main stem primarily. They are less suited to, or it's harder to manage flows in tributary, in subcatchments or in tributaries. And hence the need often to set residual flows as well as minimum flows. So often you'll see that takes in tributaries are subject to minimum flow at the bottom of the catchment to make sure that everything is hunky-dory in the main stem, and also a residual flow that looks after the values in the tributary. So what I'm saying is a minimum flow will help perhaps in the main stem, but it might not be effective in the tributaries.
And I think all I can say is we have simply reflected back the evidence, particularly for Manuhirakia and its three flows on the main stem, and the advice given by your own experts that both these tributaries and the main stem were being managed to attain those flows. Now, if that wasn't correct and the court shouldn't have given that any weight, I wish I'd known that earlier whilst thinking about possible solutions. You don't need to comment on that. If it's a no-go, it's a no-go, but I thought it was at least worthy of reflecting back, given that that was the evidence.
Yeah. And we haven't discussed it between ourselves, so my colleagues might have a different view.
Sally Dicey, I agree with Mr. Tapalsmaker in terms of the minimum flow is definitely a driver at a catchment level, but residuals at a sub-catchment or tributary scale do add another safety net for the localised values. So I agree with the statement on the tributaries. I would also add, in terms of using the minimum flow as a replacement for priorities over the next 6 years, I'd have concerns about that with the Manuhiri Care, and just at a high level, and I understand that the suggestion was to use the campground voluntary flow of 900
right. So
as well.
The suggestion has been to use the flows that the whole of Manuhiri Care is actually working to, including, we were told, the tributaries, which are also working to those flows, notwithstanding there's no residual. And that's been achieved through private arrangements and through the management, I guess, of your Roger Williams. And no doubt other racemen, but Roger Williams. So if that is not true or inaccurate, I wish we'd been told that.
I think it is true.
Right. Okay.
It is true, but what we're saying, we're not...
So I'm not using minimum flows nor residual in any technical sense. We're just trying to reflect back what is happening in reality. We are not saying that that is a minimum flow which has an environmental outcome. There's no evidence to suggest that those are flows which are having a positive environmental outcome. But those are the arrangements as between users to step over the problem of priority. And so that's why we were reflecting it back.
And I'm not... I'm not disagreeing in terms of the way that the catchment... has been, or the evidence to date on how the catchment has worked. I think what Mr. Tapalsmaker and I are referring to in terms of tributaries is that sometimes there can be an even more fine-grained approach within the tributary that the minimum flow and that wider catchment management may not account for.
But when you're talking about Manuhiri Care, let's focus on that, because I don't understand there are residual flows on the troops. Is that right?
No, that's right.
But nevertheless, they are... adhering to that informal management for the whole of catchment. Is that right or not?
Not at a residual, my understanding, not at a residual flow level
Ms. Dicey,
yet.
I have said several times, I acknowledge there's no residual flows on the tributaries.
Yep.
Okay, so that's, we're not interested in using minimum flows or residual flows insofar as you understand those terms. Insofar as that might have a flow sharing or environmental outcome, we're just simply trying to mimic where the catchment has got to in order to preserve its, in order to ensure that there is flow for all users. Now, I'm saying that because while your lawyers might take a different view from Dr. Somerville, nevertheless, we have to have all options open to us. And if it was your options are just simply to repeat priorities and hope that you can take them down. But if that's not open to you, what's your fallback position?
Can I carry on in terms of my concern with the Manuhiri Care?
Only address it in the way that I've proposed.
And correct me if I've understood it incorrectly. If I've misunderstood that, please let me know. But I understood the suggestion to be to use the campground minimum flow to help the catchment carry on working together.
The suggestion was use the three minimum flows. Two will be carried down by conditions of consent anyway. So that's the flow at Ofa and the flow at the Falls Dam together with the voluntary flow at campground.
Yep.
And the suggestion was that all consents as an entry condition adhere to those flows. Those flows are recorded in a schedule. So effectively mimicking what is happening in reality through the informal arrangements, but I suspect those informal arrangements are rather formally documented, but anyway, arrangements in the Manuhiri Care.
So I think one of the issues with that, so the residual at Falls Dam is met, that's a current condition of consent. The OFA minimum flow, as my understanding, is it doesn't really bite. It's, it doesn't act as a key driver in terms of people reducing their takes. So the campground one has been a key driver in recent years, but it is, it's not a regulatory minimum flow.
No, and I was proposing that it would be.
I know, that's and so difference. Because it's not a regulatory minimum flow, it's, say, a soft target, and we have had experience in the catchment to date that when it has been a very dry season, that target hasn't been met.
Okay.
And so there's potential that if it was made a hard target, that that would necessitate infrastructure changes, again, leading back into that problem of there's a six-year permit, infrastructure changes being needed on a six-year permit, difficulties financing that, not sure what the future regime is going to be, you know, loss of allocation potentially in the future, reliability with whatever minimum flows are brought in under the land and water regional plan. So again, it's very different in terms of voluntary flow sharing to a soft target, where if it's an incredibly dry season, the regional council said, yep, you guys can drop it down to 600 litres a second instead of 900. So it's quite a different proposition.
Right. Well, that's fine if that has no merit. I'm just saying you'll need a backstop because the court has to determine a rather serious legal issue.
Yep.
Hasn't heard from council as to why those rights of priority can be carried down. We'll do so in June. And you'll need a backstop.
So just staying with the issue of the flow at campground, the 900 litres per second, can you describe the effect that the existing priorities have in terms of how that 900 litres per second is or plays out in practice? So I guess my question is, do the existence currently of priorities have a bearing on the minimum flow of this voluntary minimum flow of 900?
My understanding, and I'm not the expert by any means in terms of how the catchment works, but it, just at a high level I can give you an answer, is that the Manuhirikia Irrigation Cooperative Society, say I'll call it the Manuhirikia Scheme, they have the higher priority in the catchment, but they have set that aside and have entered into the what's colloquially known as the Falls Dam Agreement. It's actually the Falls Dam Constitution, and that all the parties, the major parties, are the key schemes in that catchment, have agreed to set aside their priorities in the operation of water management in the catchment, but that is a key kind of underpinning factor to get schemes located higher in the catchment to be part of that agreement, because a scheme lower in the catchment has power with the priority to actually step outside of the agreement and call their priority. So in terms of day-to-day management, they're not adhered to in that kind of macro level, but they underpin the Falls Dam Agreement.
Would a minimum flow reflective of that priority achieve the same purpose?
Oh, sorry, can you explain for me what you mean by a minimum flow reflective of that priority?
So the priority, the highest priority is lower down the catchment, I've understood that.
The second from the bottom in terms of the bigger scheme. So Galloway Irrigation Society is the lowest, and then it's the Manuhirikia scheme is the second up the catchment from the bottom.
And just to put into the frame of reference, the recorder at the campground is upstream or downstream from the highest priority take?
Manahirikia scheme take from upstream of the campground recorder?
And so if you had a minimum flow at the camp stream recorder, that would still need to be met by the highest priority take?
It would, but Omakau Area Irrigation Company are located higher in the catchment, so they could take the water before it gets to the Manahirikia scheme take. They could potentially take the water and leave not enough for the Manahirikia scheme to also access their allocation without them breaching the minimum flow.
And so the outcome of simply having a minimum flow at the campground would be essentially to reverse the priority of those abstractors upstream?
Theoretically, yes.
From a drafting perspective, if given time, could you draft a framework that relied on minimum flows? So I guess my question is it a drafting challenge or is it an outcome issue you're concerned about?
Sorry, I realise I haven't been prefacing my answers with my name, so Sally Dicey in answer to that question. I think it goes beyond a drafting issues for the reasons I outlined to Her Honour just before. And I'm only talking at the very kind of macro scale on the main stem. I think there also is the interface with the tributaries and how the race manager manages the entire catchment, or almost the entire catchment, not just those big main stem takes. So it's much more coordinated and fine-grained than just those three large takes that I've been talking about, or three schemes. Also, in terms of putting in a minimum flow, again, that would create a hard regulatory minimum flow, which is not what has happened in the catchment to date. The catchment, if there has been an incredibly dry year, has had the ability to go below that target. And so that hasn't necessitated for everybody infrastructure changes. And so that circles back, as I was saying, to that issue of six-year permits and having to invest or change infrastructure within a six-year permit timeframe.
Mr. Brass, is there anything that you would like to add in relation to the court's suggested approach? Are there any other, do you see any other benefits or any other fish hooks?
I guess if I try to simply summarise my understanding of how things work, currently the minimum flow, or in a number of catchments, the expectation of a minimum flow, sets that catchment-wide limit that everybody within the catchment is required to meet. The priorities are part of, at least, the equation of between the different users, how that water is taken and where to ultimately meet that minimum flow at a specific point in the main stem. So by just retaining the minimum flow, you don't retain the how it's apportioned between users currently, and you would be dependent on people voluntarily retaining that, and when water gets tight, that might or might not work. I guess we'll just check, is particularly with Sally, because I don't claim understanding of the operation of the Manahirikia, but would that be a reasonable summary of the priorities being used in terms of how the water is managed between the users to meet the minimum flow?
Yes.
Mr. De Pelsmaker, is there anything else you'd like to add to that topic?
I'm in the same boat as Mr. Brass. I don't have detailed familiarity with how the scheme is operating on the ground. What I think is happening is that the flow regimes in the Manaharikia are predicated on the existence of a voluntary minimum flow at the campground, and then there's also the over one and the required base flow at Falls Dam, but also on the existence of the flow sharing agreement, the Falls Dam agreement. What I've heard is that's underpinned by priorities, and I've asked myself the question, what's the longevity of that agreement as well? If the priorities fall away, will the Falls Dam agreement cease to exist as well? If it isn't, then you might actually get the same, you might still be able to achieve those flows at specified flow monitoring sites, but the flow regimes between them or at various reaches within the catchment might be different while still achieving those minimum flows. There might be a different pattern of taking. And that is, I think, in both the Tari and the Manaharikia, it could be one of the underlying reasons is that the flow can be provided for by one single user, which is Falls Dam in the Manaharikia, or the Logan Burn in at least part of the Tari, the Upper Tari.
Okay, I want to move on now to...
Sorry, Sally Dicey, can I just add from a perspective on the Tari catchment as well? The issue that I see with the Tari catchment is that we've only got 22% of allocation left to fall under PC7, with the remaining 78% already allocated for longer permits. And so if a minimum flow was applied to permits under PC7, then that either relies on all other permit holders voluntarily adhering, those that don't have the minimum flow, and a portion of that 78% does have a minimum flow condition on them, but a large portion doesn't. No, I don't, sorry, I don't. I'm aware that at some point in time the ORC was imposing the minimum flow conditions, and then they switched their approach to bring themselves in line with the rules in the plan, which said that the minimum flows were to be applied on review of the permits, a collective review after expiry on 2021. So that acknowledged that most of the permits, you know, would be up for renewal, and that process of renewing permits would be done in 2021. And so a large portion of permits don't have, a large portion of permits that have already been replaced, my understanding is they don't have the minimum flow on them. And so that would either, that would necessitate a review of those permits that have been replaced for a long term, or would rely on voluntary, voluntarily meeting the minimum flows. So that's another issue from the Tyree perspective.
The evidence that we've received that holders of deemed permits are managing, regulating themselves, if I could put it that way, by adhering to the minimum flow, was that incorrect?
No, they are. So that's
what's the value then for them in operating that way when not everybody is actually on minimum flows? And by when I say everybody, I mean those consents already replaced and on minimum flows. Why would deemed permits bother to go there?
I think groups of deemed permit holders have been working in together because you've got a mix. They're all neighbours. There has been, you know, a reason in some parts of the Tyree catchment, I think a good degree of cohesion, and they've been working in together just in recognition that it's something they've got to gear up for. So they're anticipating that that minimum flow would be applied to them in 2021, and they've been practising for it, really.
And so are you saying that if the court has understood the evidence to be that this is what holders of deemed permits are doing, that's not entirely correct? Some may not be.
That's right. So those my understanding is those in certain places along the main stem, particularly above Waipiata, the Waipiata minimum flow, have been flow sharing in compliance with the minimum flow. But I know of other deemed permit holders that sit on tributaries flowing into the Tyree catchment that haven't been. Right. And again, that's that can be due to hydrological characteristics where those tributaries are very low by the time the minimum flow is being approached in the main stem. So there's a whole range of kind of complex factors.
There might be, but the court is waiting for that evidence. And I think the difficulty we have is that we're receiving evidence from a range of witnesses, which is contradictory as between those witnesses. And very difficult for the court then to be thinking about what a policy response could be here.
So just following up, those anticipating practising examples, you know, you talked about the Waipiata, but you kept coming back to deemed permit holders. What about the replacement permit holders? Are they part of this practising?
Yes, some of them are. So again, if they're on the main stem, and I think there are inherent contradictions, and because there are, you know, each permit holder is their own individuals. In some places you get people working together cohesively. In other places, they haven't yet. They're in sub-catchment or tributaries and they don't feel connected to people on the main stem. They don't feel like the minimum flow should apply to them. So I understand that frustration because there are a huge range of responses and actions that are happening out there.
Thanks for clarifying that.
So moving on now to think about the last 2 points on the slide, which relate to recommendations about amendments that could be made to Plan Change 7 to provide the regulatory backstop. Can you explain perhaps at a broad level the way in which you might approach that task, perhaps starting with what adjustments you might need to make at a policy level, and then we'll circle back and see what adjustments might need to be made in terms of the rule framework.
Tom de Palsemaker. I explained before there are probably two ways. You could either amend an existing policy, proposed policy in Plan Change 7. The first one that springs to mind is Policy 10A21. Add an additional clause that basically requires the imposition of a condition that seeks to continue the flow sharing arrangement that has been established by priorities under a previous deemed permit. You could also have that as a separate policy as well. I think it's probably important to say that it is an interim measure as well, that the priorities should not continue to exist beyond the new plan becoming operative.
So we'll hear from the other two witnesses, and then I'll have a follow-up.
I agree with Mr. De Palsemaker on that one. In terms of adding into the existing policy 10A21, it could be an extra arm of that, and I think definitely using plain English and defining, the history of how the status of priorities would be helpful.
And Murray Brass. Yeah, and I would see in the same way as the existing policy 10A21D refers to any existing residual flow, minimum flow, or take cessation condition, that it would be a direct carryover of existing rights of priority, so it's not opening up a new matter of open discretion, if you like.
Now, I detected a slight nuance in Mr. De Palsemaker's answer about how you might go about describing these priorities, and I wanted to understand a little further whether your nuance was around shifting away from simply saying we're bringing down priorities to referring to the flow regime in place in light of the priorities. I just wanted to understand whether that was intentional language on your part.
I think it's probably better to move away from the term priority in the new consents, recognising that they existed under the expired deemed permits. That was my reasoning behind it.
Yes. Do the other witnesses agree with the need to shift away in terms of the language because of what might be created under Plan Change 7 isn't simply continuation on of priorities?
Not necessarily, because I think permit holders in Otago are very familiar with that term. I guess that, on the other hand, there's a risk that because they're so familiar with it, they don't understand it will be a different beast in the future. But if that beast pretty much imitates what has historically existed but is, you know, created under the PC7 and the conditions, then I think that wording could be retained, but as I said, some a definition as to what is meant by it would be necessary.
Murray Brass, and I would agree that the language would need to be plain enough that a user understands what it is that it's doing, but then the language of the new provision, and in my evidence I suggested a take cessation worded condition, that would need to be sort of fully under RMA terms rather than referring to priorities.
Okay. Mr. De Pelsmaker also mentioned a need to ensure that if the drafting brought down the essence of priorities, however described, it didn't create a perpetual right of priority under Section 124B, I think it is. Just from a drafting perspective, is that something which could be managed through the careful drafting of provisions?
Yes. I don't know if it necessarily needs to be in a in the policy, especially if we would define the term right of priority elsewhere in the glossary. But it would always be helpful to have at least an advice note, just to avoid the potential for confusion.
What sort of confusion do you think might arise?
I think that what Mr. Ma was referring to was the use of the term priority in Section 124B, which...
124B?
124B, yes. Which I think has to do with...
124, capital B of the RMA.
And that is clause 2 under...
Just checking.
Sorry. Two, or section 2, sorry, section 124, capital B, 2. The application described in subsection 1B is entitled to priority.
Ah, yes.
Which is a totally different concept.
Yes.
But it might help, especially, you know, given that in both cases we're dealing with application processes.
Do either of the other witnesses want to make a comment, or no? Do you agree that the drafting should make clear that a perpetual right of priority isn't being established?
I'm just wondering how you're going to achieve that, given that the government hasn't achieved that. And it's a fair question, isn't it?
Sally Dicey. So they would be granted on six-year permits with a condition on a six-year permit, so theoretically that would expire at the same date as would all other conditions of the consent, so when the permit expires. So I guess it is comes down to, it has a section 124 right of continuance, but you know, if an application is lodged, but actually no expectation that that right will necessarily remain.
But that wasn't the proposition I put to you. If the government can't achieve it in the in a piece of legislation, how can you achieve it?
Sorry, I was answering Mr. Moore's question.
So I'm putting a proposition to you that under your current theory, you can, and I know your lawyers are going to say, oh, but, you know, finally expire doesn't mean finally expire. You know, the deemed permits, and that they can continue. How can you put into place an effective something that says rights of priority do finally expire?
I'm not sure.
I'm just really confused as to what you're suggesting, whether you're suggesting a continuation of a statutory right or whether you're doing something else.
I'm not sure, though, that the two are at odds from my perspective. We can accept that they've expired as the RMA had laid them out. So the RMA has said they're going to expire in October 2021. We're accepting that. We had anticipated, and the whole of Otago has accepted that and prepared on the basis that they were expiring. And the lead-up under the RPW, the operative plan, a lot of the flow sharing preparation, the water management group preparation, and the work done by the ORC to set up and help support that was in anticipation of deemed permits finally expiring, was in anticipation of priorities finally expiring, and there were application processes afoot and have been lodged which anticipated that expiry and sought to replace them with something else. The problem is now we've just been left potentially in limbo without the opportunity to do those substantive assessments with this interim framework that doesn't acknowledge or allow for or assist with any kind of transition away from the priority. So I'm not actually in disagreement at all that they finally expire. I see that as very clear-cut and simple. I'm speaking far more to the ability to replicate something within the RMA framework.
So you are agreeing that they have finally or will it finally expire on the 1st of October, but your proposition is not, your proposition is to do something which replicates their effect. Is that what you're saying?
That's right.
Right. Probably dangerous to use the language of priority, though I understand why you're saying use the language of priority. Because people understand it.
That's right.
Mr. Brass, anything further to add?
I think from my point of view, the right of priority fully expires. It would be, the effect of it, if you like, would be replaced with a new specific condition on a specific consent and is subject to the term of that consent. And then anything subsequent would be, any replacement consent would be subject to whatever the plan regime and conditions that apply at that point in time. So from that point of view, if there was a take cessation or however it was worded, condition for the 6-year consent, there would be and should be, as with any other condition, no expectation that that's going to automatically continue on subsequent consents.
So in a sense, what you have in mind is a replication, and using Her Honour's language, a replication of the effect of the priorities. And in a sense, the framework would need to draw that distinction in terms of not simply continuing on what we understand to be priorities. There's a language challenge.
There is, so it need to be clear to users, consent applicants, that you had one of these, you're getting one of those, and they are different.
Albeit achieving the same effect.
achieving the same effect, but different mechanisms.
Right, so we've talked, well, we've started at the policy level. Are you able to share any thinking that has perhaps developed in terms of the rule framework and how that might respond to the achievement of the effect of priorities?
I'll pick up where Mr. Brass left. He referred to the term take cessation condition. My initial thoughts are that within the rule framework, it might be possible to craft an entry condition that requires applicants to volunteer a proposed condition in their application, whereby they commit to cease water taking on request of the permit holder who previously held a higher right of priority.
So you foresee that from a drafting perspective, the way in which to achieve the outcome is to have an entry condition in the first instance for the controlled activity and possibly for the RDA.
For the RDA as well. Yes. An entry condition and a matter of control or discretion.
We'll come back to the matter of control and or discretion. I'm interested in the thoughts of the other planners as to whether they share your opinion in relation to an entry condition being the appropriate way to manage the effect.
Sally Dicey, yes, I'd support that. My only kind of addition to that would be it's not always just a take cessation condition. It would be a take reduction as well, because it's not always about telling other people to turn off. It can be about telling other people to turn down. So that would be the only other aspect I'd add to what Mr. DePausmaker said.
Murray Brass, and yes, I agree with that as well. And I would just note that while I've suggested some wording for a take cessation condition, I'm not wedded to that. It's about, if you like, creating that effect. And certainly open on what the wording for that could be.
So, assuming then for present purposes that an entry condition has been created, would there also need to be a matter of control and or a matter of discretion for the council in relation to or responding to the entry condition for the purposes of imposing a condition?
That seems a logical approach, yes. It gives council discretion as to whether they on what terms or in what circumstances, yeah, they would impose that condition.
Yes, Sally Dicey, sorry. It would definitely set up the expectation that a condition reflecting historic access to water under the priority system would be imposed on the six-year permit.
Can I just check that I've got this down right? The entry condition, it's a voluntary, that what we're volunteering to reduce or restrict. The take, is that what you said? Sorry, didn't pick it up right. The entry condition is what?
So basically in the application, the applicant offers up a proposed condition whereby he commits to cease or restrict taking on request of a water permit holder who currently holds a permit with a higher right of priority.
So the entry condition is that the applicant volunteers or commits to reducing or restricting on application of a superior permit.
The application needs to demonstrate it. Yeah.
Demonstrate what?
That he will commit to that.
How does that work when you've got civil rights or priority on the same water body?
It will mean that both sides, the applicant and council as well, have to check the current, which are the relevant permits that need to be taken into account, and what's their status? Have they been replaced already? And if so, does the replacement consent have a right of priority or something to that effect stated on it as well? So, it's not straightforward. I think there will be quite some administrative work involved.
So if you take a catchment like the Blowburn, because they're not really, you know, they haven't needed to have exercised their rights of priority, of which there are many rights of priority there, and they haven't particularly exercised them because there's always been flow to take. So, but that's one, is possibly two at least, water bodies flowing into the Blowburn, then out to the lake. You've got multiple rights of priority, each, you know, with successive rights over the other. So two questions. Blowburn, last 25 years, fairly consistent evidence, never had to exercise it. Would you impose it on Blowburn?
Because it is on request.
What is on request?
On request by another water permit holder.
Oh, yeah.
I wouldn't impose it.
No, would the Blowburn applicants need to go under what you're proposing?
Excuse me?
Would the Blowburn applicants have to offer this?
I would think so. I think that's the best approach in terms of consistency.
Yep, okay. Then in terms of your how this works for Blowburn with multiple rights, how would that work?
From what I've heard so far in the hearing, there seems to be good awareness or reasonable awareness amongst the permit holders whether there are other permits in that catchment that have a right of priority, but it needs to be checked by council as well. So
if I am, for example, if I have the highest right of priority, are all other applicants for replacement consents who are deemed permits subject to my right, or are they only subject to like the next right in the rank? So just say I'm now number four and I'm only subject to what number three wants me to do. I'm not subject to what number two or what number one wants me to do. So how does that, do you see what I mean? I mean,
yes.
I don't actually know how any of that works in practice, whether it, you know, they all go off logic, you know, in sequence, or whether one just calls the pin and says you're all off because, you know, things are looking pretty dire. So how does it work?
Yeah, to be honest, Your Honour, my thinking is still evolving in that regard. At the moment, Ms. Dicey, feel free to correct me, but my understanding is on current deemed permits, all the higher priorities are listed. I think that it makes sense to have the same approach going forward as well, given that I haven't heard any I haven't seen any information that that approach has fish hooks, so to speak.
Yeah. So
it provides clarity as well.
Yeah, for the entry condition and I guess the exit control,
yeah.
Are you thinking that each holder of a deemed permit is only subject to one superior right? So if I was number three on the rank, I'm only subject to number two's right? Or are you thinking I'm subject to number two and number one?
I would think the latter. I think that's more, sorry, that's probably the most safe or the most cautious approach. I'm thinking out loud now, but if for some reason the water permit that has the immediate right of priority over the applicant is being surrendered, it could cause the flow regime or the whole system to fall over potentially.
Why is that?
Because then the applicant is no longer bound to, is no longer part of the wider priority system that might still exist.
Is that just, does that situation only arise if only the immediate, we'll call it the dominant permit,
yes,
was recorded? So if your fourth priority was only subservient to number three?
Yes, for, so if number four would fall away, the subservient permit would no longer be tied to any flow regime that seeks to mimic the effects of priorities. So I think it is more prudent to have all the priorities listed on the, well, on or whatever is put in place on the new consents.
So just to be clear about that, if you're the fourth ranking permit in the catchment, that permit would be subject to priorities 1, 2 and 3 as opposed to just number 3.
That is what I was thinking.
Yeah. Ms. Dicey, I see you having a contribution to make.
Reaching for the microphone. Sally Dicey, yeah, I would agree that all of the priorities would, if the priorities are going to be included as an entry condition, then it would need to be all of them. So the pig burn was an example where you heard number one called priority on number five, and I know Mr. Weir said he'd only done that, say, 4 times out of the last 10 years, which... But yes, that was between number one and number five. And then my recollection is number three and four are further down the catchment and are really only in interplay, or in the past may have only interplayed between each other. So I think if that is how it's done through an entry condition, it would need to be all of the priorities listed. I think there's potentially, you know, an opportunity through an application form to simply be... tick, is there a right of priority over you, list all of the priorities, you know, that basically it's a copy and paste so that council can see it. And there's also an opportunity to ask or provide people with an out from that entry condition if all priority holders that are interconnected give their written approval to step away. So it would have to be all of them, because otherwise you would get number five saying, yes, I'll step away from mine, and number one saying, hold on a minute, no, you can't. So if there is, say, in the low burn, discrete examples where priorities, the permit holders are completely happy to step away, there's no issue for them, then perhaps that can also be drafted in as an entry condition, a written approval from all of those interconnected priorities.
Mr. Brass.
Confirm my agreement with that, and also part of my concern there is that essentially as soon as council starts looking at the five priorities and picking this one and not that one, you're getting into discretion and complexity, and then the need to understand the effects, and you're moving away from
that very simple, straightforward renewal approach. So I'm certainly seeing something that's more of an accounting exercise as opposed to an exercise of judgment, if you like.
So playing this out a little further, so conceptually you've described what a planning framework might look like. I want then to you to cast your mind conceptually to what then the type of condition on a permit might look like, and it's been described variously as a flow restriction or a flow cessation condition. But do you see that working perhaps in a way where the holder of a permit, and let's say it's a subservient permit, so one with lower priority, they would have to cease taking water when or if requested, they would have to cease or reduce taking water when requested, and it might be requested in writing or a mechanism requested by the holder of consents 1, 2 and 3 if those hold priority. Is that how it might appear?
Yes, yep. I agree that it would be good to have some kind of a formalised procedure included in the condition, but yeah.
Sally Dicey, yes, I agree with that.
Mary Brass, and I agree as well.
And when you think about the need for a formalised procedure and the potential for the council to become the council would then be charged with enforcement responsibilities, there would need to be a clear mechanism with clear evidence of such a request having been made.
Correct. I think it's appropriate to have a formalised procedure that involves council. Based on the evidence that I've heard as well, in most circumstances, they are being exercised rather sporadically. So I don't think that is too much of a hurdle for permit holders.
Sally Dicey, yes, I agree. I think it would have to be in writing, otherwise it can't be something that the council can then get involved in without that.
So at the moment, it is sporadic, I think, as the evidence is. Council's never told. So what are you suggesting? That if it's exercised, there has to be notification given to the council?
Yes, I think, yeah, correct.
And I guess I'd note that that's no barrier to people still sorting things out over the back fence or the kitchen table. But again, you need to have that backstop there to give teeth to that.
Tom DePulsmaker, I also think that there's a benefit for council as well, because it actually gives council a better idea as to what the flow regimes are, I think it gives an additional layer of information, or makes an additional layer of information available to council as well.
I just want to pick up on the point Mr. Brass made about perhaps there not being an impediment to that informal flow sharing, which the evidence given in this proceeding demonstrates is happening. So do you see that the informal flow sharing arrangements could continue, but only if the take cessation is being requested pursuant to the permit, that would be captured in writing?
So just slow that one down, it's quite a long question.
Yes.
Informal flow sharing could continue only if, yep, that's halfway as far as I got.
So the informal flow sharing could continue without the need in this context for anything in writing. But if a formal request in reliance on a condition was to be made, that formal request would need to be in writing.
Yes, I'd agree with that. And although it wasn't part of my previous answer, I would note that I agree with Mr. DePolsemaker, sorry, this is Murray Brass speaking, I'd agree with Mr. DePolsemaker that having that information through to council would have that added benefit in terms of council's understanding of how things are operating.
Ms. Dicey, any observations to share?
No, I agree. I agree with your proposition, and I agree with Mr. Brass. Flow sharing can carry on, it can be trialled, people can carry on working cooperatively, but there's that need for that regulatory backstop. So, yeah.
So, in a sense, it's the existence of a consent holder's ability to formally request somebody to cease taking that's driving the community flow sharing that we're seeing. For example, in the Lowburn, where it wasn't so much the formal exercising of priorities for the most part.
That can certainly be one driver for flow sharing.
And are there any others that you need to bring to our attention so that we can assess the effectiveness of this?
Not within this context. I think beyond neighbours looking after neighbours or people anticipating a minimum flow or people preparing for the expiry of deemed permits and priorities and a full, you know, their expectation that they were about to go through a full substantive consent application. Those were the other kind of drivers that I had in mind, Your Honour.
So we've stepped, I guess, conceptually through what a framework might look like. In terms of converting that concept
because I was interested in what you might have as matters of control matters of discretion, which I see as really where the rubber's going to hit the road as well, and understanding more clearly what is intended there.
Sure. So let's drill down a little in terms of the matter of control for the controlled activity and then the matter of discretion that will respond to the entry condition that you've described. What is it that you would have in mind in terms of the matter of control?
Basically a provision that allows for the imposition of a condition on any consents granted under that control activity rule to continue the existing water sharing agreements that were created by that right of priority.
Now, are you using the phrase water sharing to reflect priorities or something else?
Priorities, yeah.
I appreciate trying not to call them priorities, yes, whilst describing priorities as a challenge. Okay, Ms. Dicey, is that how you understand the matter of control might operate?
Yes, I do agree. It would, not carrying over, but a recreation of or mimicking of, I agree.
Reflecting the effect of priorities, perhaps is one way to put it.
Yeah, Murray Brass, and I agree also with that, and I think you could either contain that reflecting the existing within the matter of control or have it something that clearly flows from the policy, but either way it needs to be quite clear that it's replicating something, it's not the ability to create something new.
Ms. Dicey? Oh, no.
Go on, your answer. I was just wondering in terms of the control, whether this might be something that council might need to get into a little bit, in the sense of whether people have, like you said, checking that they've surrendered their priorities. But I'm mindful, I think it might have been in relation to the small burn, where we were told that the actual race on which all the priorities had been based was no longer functioning within a sort of a given length. So there may be situations that might require a little bit more digging into, which of course is something that you've been trying to avoid in terms of your controlled and even your restricted discretionary, which is really just addressing the data deficiency under the schedule question. So, I'm just asking the question, really.
And added to that, when we've been reflecting on something similar, we wondered whether you actually had to have a schedule of those priorities, that it wasn't good enough to... I know you're moving away from the language of priorities, and I actually think that's wise if, in fact, there's, you know, the court finds itself has jurisdiction. But we had actually thought, well, you know, better actually have a schedule where these things are in. And it doesn't mean to...
2 or 3 weeks it's, into the hearing.
Just to backstop what the idea was.
Yeah, we started that discussion at lunchtime about creating the schedule, the tree, as I understand it, the priority tree, in terms of which permits have priority over each other and which permits have been replaced and what's the new replacement number. From an administrative perspective, I would have thought that exercise at a minimum would need to be carried out. There's then a question about whether that should actually then form a schedule in the plan to provide for ease of administration of the plan, or whether it sits as outside of the plan as a document that can be updated as the new consent numbers come through. So,
only raises, well, because A, I think it may be important to make it effective, and we'd thought about that earlier, but B, you say your databases aren't that great in terms of dialing up existing permits and actually understanding whether those races are even operational with those deemed permits on.
Yeah, in terms of the... what would be required is essentially eyes over each of the deemed permits to be replaced, because each permit does record the priorities on the face of the permit. In terms of the question of what do you do with these races that may have been disestablished, the follow-up question I was about to put to the panel was one of, does it matter if those, and I'll call them priorities, if those priorities come down onto the permits for the next 6 years, in the sense that it probably doesn't matter that they aren't going to be exercised, there's knowledge that they're not going to be, so does it matter if they come down? Is that the easier solution than having to find out or draft or put a matter of control on the council to understand whether they have or haven't been exercised?
So just to answer that question first, Murray Brass, that yes, I think it would be best and easiest to simply replicate them. In terms of the question about when things have changed in terms of races and making sure that you do carry that over, when I was working at the regional council doing exactly this, it was in the early days of the Act, and so we were issuing replacements of deemed permits that carried over the existing, and they were put on the permit, as you've seen, essentially as a little schedule or a table. It was seen as an accounting exercise rather than making judgment calls. It can be difficult to do sometimes, particularly when you're dealing with handwritten copper plate documents from 150 years ago. But it is doable. It's something that the council has done before, and I'm quite certain that they're capable of doing that. It does need some detective work at times, but I'm quite confident that that is able to be done, and I would support them being carried on the, at least the permits, as a table or schedule. That's the clearest way to make it plain. The creation of, if you like, a
a super table that puts them all together, I would in principle support, but I would defer to the regional council as to whether that's achievable.
Tom de Palsmaker, I feel a little bit uncomfortable committing my colleagues in the consents administration team, but I believe that a schedule would assist. I believe that it is something the more, or at the initial stages, it will be hard to kind of assemble, although I have seen previous schedules that probably need updating, but that provide some kind of a baseline information. I think it is best to keep it outside of the plan, especially because of the need of regular updating. As I said before, some deemed permits might be surrendered, might not be renewed. Others that have been replaced, the numbers need to be updated. I think from a plan administration point of view, that might be challenging to keep track of that. That's my response in regards to the schedule. Having a provision in the plan that in some cases is not does not result in conditions that are going to be enforced is not something that I would advocate for. It's not good plan writing. But given that this is an interim plan change as well, I think those are some circumstances that it might be allowed for.
So it's allowed for, I've lost the track for RPMTs coming up soon.
Oh, yes.
Sorry. It is probably not best practice to respond to an issue that you're not quite, that you don't have a full grasp on in terms of the scale or the incidents or even the risks around it. I think it's definitely something that I wouldn't want to do in the land and water plan, but this is an interim plan change and we're dealing with an immediate problem that could have significant risks. So under those circumstances, just a carryover kind of provision might be warranted.
You mean a pretend provision? I'm not sure where you're going here. Anyway, your responses are one with central government or this plan change, or both, as I see it. If it's with this plan change, are you saying that you kind of have a faux pretend provision, you know, that
no.
We're going to enforce it, but we're not really going to enforce it?
We're going to enforce it on request, you know.
So how do you do that? Okay, so I've told my neighbour to stop taking.
Mm-hmm.
How are you going to enforce that? What things would you look for? You'd say, I have to do it in writing. So, okay, I've done it in writing. What are you going to do if the neighbour doesn't stop taking but the flows come back?
Notify council.
Okay, what do you expect the council to do?
With other compliance issues, council usually follows up with a phone call. That doesn't work, a letter, and it's only after that hard enforcement is taken.
I've forgotten. I can't find it. It's not to hand, but it's somewhere in the RMA. At the moment, consent holders can't enforce themselves, I think, but the regional council could enforce a priority. Is that right? I don't know. It's in there somewhere.
Yep. Ms. Williams for the Director General, just for the benefit of the transcript. There's the carryover provisions from the Water and Soil Conservation Act, Your Honour, which allow for the civil enforcement to be done. So that's basically a priority holder going to, I think it's the High Court, and requesting the court to enforce.
I didn't have that in mind. What section is that?
It's somewhere in the Water and Soil Conservation Amendment Act 1971.
Okay. You can come back to me about that, but yep. I did actually find the section I was after, 413 subsection 6.
Yes.
No enforcement order may be made under section 319 against the holder of any deemed permit in respect to the activity to which the permit relates, except upon an application under section 316 by a council or by the minister. And you've never taken any enforcement action, but then again, you may never have been. You don't seem to know what's actually happening out there with priorities because it's not reported. So, are you suggesting that? You're suggesting what in terms of enforcement action?
That enforcement action should be undertaken by council. I'm not sure whether we can rely on section 413, given that priorities will cease to exist, and that we're ultimately what's in the new consent will be a condition that is.
I don't think you can. Well, yeah. I mean, Dr. Somerville says you can't, but your lawyers might say you can. But that aside, you're suggesting what?
The normal range of enforcement.
Yes, yeah.
Or
yeah.
any water permit, is that what you're suggesting? So you could start with a polite letter and go into an abatement notice, an enforcement order, and ultimately or a prosecution. Is that what you're thinking?
Yeah, yes.
The full gamut being available, whether it's exercised or not, that's another question.
But it's just another brick bat, yeah. And you say that because you've had a look at the enforcement section?
No, I have not.
No.
I just think, given that it is a condition on a resource consent, it would be best to apply the normal standard practice of council.
It's a long time since I dealt with enforcement orders. Only councils can do abatement notices, but can't anyone apply for an enforcement order? Isn't that the law? I've got some people nodding at me. I must have had a case once where someone came along and did that. Yeah. I did have one more question. Do you think that I could just go back to the answer that, well, the proposition that somebody put? I thought that it was Ms. Dicey about all the people that in the priority tree could agree to give written approval to this being dispensed with, and I guess I was wondering how that worked in with the notion of the policy and what it is you're trying to achieve. So I just wanted to put that out there. Maybe people could think about that over the afternoon break and then I could ask the question again.
Do you mean in terms
afterwards?
Of getting neighbour's approval, or if you can call them a neighbour, a neighbour's approval, a affected party's approval?
Everybody in the priority tree agreeing to give their written approval and you know, that would be the end of it. So I'm assuming that the council probably wouldn't be able to inquire into it at that point. So I just wondered about that in terms of the policy proposition that was floated very early on as to why you might do this thing in the first place.
Would you like me to answer that now or after?
Well, I don't really mind if you've got.
I can while it's fresh in my
head. You've got an answer, that's fine.
So I think the simplest, most process-based approach is definitely the purest kind of form of replication. So that would just be mimicking what exists currently and not questioning whether they've been utilised or how often they've been utilised or what kind of, you know, flow regime that's created at its most complex end of the spectrum. But that there could be an opportunity and, you know, this is just an idea and I definitely wouldn't kind of pursue this if there were kind of issues raised with it or there were too many process issues with it. So the example, I think it was the borough race, was it, that had blown out and it was the borough race that had the priorities attached to it. I think I read
that
in the transcripts.
Was that the small burn or something?
Okay.
It doesn't matter.
And so that in that case, it might be possible to allow for an almost an out from having from having to agree to the priorities. If all of the people in the priority tree acknowledge and give their written approval that they no longer want to retain them, then that would be fine. But you'd need everybody in the tent for that. And maybe that's adding in too much complexity, but that would be the only way I could see allowing for that without creating a need for assessment.
Were you getting at that, or were you asking more generally whether neighbours' approval had to be given to every application?
No, well, at the moment it's framed in a way that if you're going on the controlled and RD route, the neighbours don't even get a lock-in. So I guess I was just responding to something that you put out there, and I was taking it back to the policy question. Yeah.
What would be the benefit in removing the priorities if they weren't being exercised? Is it just an administrative efficiency that you had in mind?
There's limited benefit, but besides not carrying over stuff that doesn't need to be carried over, that was my only thinking. So as I said, it's not, you know, not a critical thing.
So you're not thinking Labor, anyway, just to clarify, you're not thinking Labor's approvals for a controlled or RD consent?
No, I wasn't. I was only referring to written approvals within a group of connected priorities where everybody said, I agree to no longer be part
of
this.
Perhaps Loburn is the example.
That would be dispensing with the requirement to have this condition.
That's right.
That's trying to replicate what existed previously under priorities.
That's exactly
that's
what I was meaning.
Just for that.
Yes, just for that. Where everybody within that priority tree says, look, there's no need for this, none of us adhere to it, none of us rely on it, let's just dispense with it now.
So I guess that's the other two might want to respond to that.
Yes, Mr. Brass.
Mr. Brass, my initial reaction is that it does potentially add complexity, but I'm not opposed to it as long as it's only in those cases where the existing priorities are of no impact whatsoever on the ground, so there's no risk in terms of changed regime. So the case where a race is blown out, it's of nothing more than historic interest. I can see that argument, but again, as I think is proposed, only where you've got all parties have given written approval to it, and again, council can process that as essentially pure machinery.
So essentially the permit coming in would have, say, five other priorities on it, and the holder of each of those dominant priorities would have had to have provided a written approval noting that they accept or agree that no condition recognising their priority should be imposed on the consent.
That would be my understanding of it, and it would certainly be tidiest if all of those related consents were coming in at the same time and being dealt with as a group rather than having some left with relic priorities on them.
Mr. De Pelsmaker, did you have a contribution?
No, I agree with Mr. Brass. I agree. It would alleviate my concern as well about having setting conditions on consents that basically have no footing in reality.
Yes, so your evidence given maybe 10 or 15 minutes ago about a concern about conditions not having any effect, that was in relation to expired or no longer being exercised permits with a high priority.
Yeah, it was not well articulated, but that was what I was getting at.
Okay. I wonder whether we might take the afternoon break.
All right, we're adjourned for 15 minutes. All rise.